Welcome to Inside the Newsroom, the Sentinel Records weekly podcast that takes a closer look at news and sports in Garland County. Hello and welcome to Inside the Newsroom. Today, the Sentinel Records managing editor Steve Moross and I are interviewing Cara Petro, Garland County's chief deputy prosecuting attorney.
Like, does it affect you?
It does. I mean, when I was younger, it was easier, I think, because I was really good at, you know, knowing that I was doing the right thing and knowing I was helping people and just kind of blocking it off. But as you continue to do this, it gets, you know, it's an overwhelming amount of exposure to trauma. And so, yes, it gets harder, especially if it's a child victim. I mean, it, or particularly vulnerable victim, or, you know, just particularly violent. I mean, it starts to take a toll for sure. You have to do self-care. You know, if you don't take a step back, it can really absorb you. But I do think that it's very rewarding work. It's hard work, you know, but it's life-changing to so many people.
Being able to help the victims and
get justice and help the victims start over and help them. I mean, really, there's so much with the grief process, you know, that they have to work through. And we always tell them that this isn't going to make this go away. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be over once they go to prison. They need to go see a therapist. They need to work through their trauma. But being part of that healing process and getting them justice is, you know, a significant reason of why we do what we do.
Especially, I guess, with murders, you know, you can't bring the victim back, but you can get them, you know, some sense of justice, closure, I guess.
Yes, they can get closure. And also, I mean, just the other part is just protecting the community. I mean, we don't want this town to ever be a place where people don't feel safe to come to. We want this to be a place where everyone enjoys going to the lake and everyone feels like they can go downtown and shop. And, you know, so when something bad happens, we need to make sure that we take care of it because we want to protect all the future people. We want to show that we don't stand for that kind of stuff in Hot Springs. We are not going to be scared to go out on the streets.
Now, when it comes to drug offenses, I know, like, there are some that are wide, but it's mostly, like,
simultaneous possession of a gun and firearm is one that's going to be a Y, yeah.
But do they ever qualify for, like, 70%?
Yes. I believe simultaneous is 70%. I hope I'm not. And, you know, Mr. Daniels does all the drug cases.
Right. Yeah, so,
like, I don't know if I can rattle them off
on
the top of my head. But I do think that that's probably the more serious one. So, but not very many of them are going to be 70%. Because it's really just reserved for the violent stuff. It's not, like, the property crimes aren't going to be, you know, 70%.
Right.
Residential burglary, if you have two prior residential burglaries and you get another one, then it's day for day, which means there's no parole eligibility. So there are things in place for if you're a habitual offender. Let's say you have a murder prior and you commit another violent offense, then again, you're going to get into this day-for-day situation. So it is built in, you know, to change the parole eligibility if you're a repeat offender.
And you've been mainly a prosecutor or always a prosecutor?
When I was fresh out of law school, I did private practice for a little, like a year and a couple months maybe, and then I became a prosecutor. Started off in district court doing DWI traffic stuff. And then I did that maybe 5 months and then went up to circuit court handling, like, property crimes. But then pretty quickly, it just seems like I had a niche for the violent crime. So I moved fairly within a year of being in circuit to doing violent crime. And then started moving towards doing, starting off with, like, batteries and stuff, then rape. And then eventually I was trying to do the murders. And I did those with Joe Graham, who's now, he used to be the chief deputy, but now he's a judge. So then when he left in 2019, that's when I became the chief deputy and kind of took over his spot, which the chief deputy is just, you know, our elected prosecuting attorney is Michelle Lawrence. And so she's who the people elected, and she just hired us. So we're just her deputy prosecutors, and all chief means is that I'm her second in command. I kind of help her with whatever she needs.
And what drew you to the prosecution and then eventually violent crime?
You know, you asked me that in the magazine, too. I just have always liked... I like Criminal Minds. I liked all the shows. I watched, even as a kid, I would read, like, Fear Street and all the different, you know, murder mysteries. James Patterson, like, I always liked that kind of stuff. I don't know why. I've just always been drawn to it. A lot of people in my family actually do, so I'm surprised I'm the only one that went with this kind of job. But, yeah, I've just always found it super interesting. And then, I mean, honestly, I don't know why I was drawn to violent crime. It just seems like the most impactful, I guess. Not that to say that other stuff isn't. It's all important. But I really like murder trials, too, because there's a lot involved in it. It's very complicated. You have to lay everything out like a huge strategy. You have to prep it a lot. There's just a lot of moving pieces. It's a challenge. So,
I have a question that might be silly, but do you perceive any personality differences between prosecutors and defense attorneys?
Well, I'm sure we have personality differences, but we're all very professional. We will fight each other in the courtroom. We're both going to do a great job, and we might be really mad at each other. But at the end, we're going to shake hands. And I can tell you that they're all there. Like, we're all friends. We all, if anyone needed anything, would be there. And there's just a professional quality about it. We're not going to be enemies at the end of the day. So,
I've always been kind of amazed at, like, over the years, prosecutors that will, like, you know, they'll be prosecutors for a while, and then they'll leave, and 9 times out of 10, they'll end up doing defense.
I know.
I've known several that, like, and even public defenders. In fact, I can name two that, you know, were prosecutors, and now they work for the public defender, and they segued seamlessly, you know.
Well, when I was in private practice, the reason I got my job was I did a murder trial and as defense with another, just sitting second chair to another attorney. It's not like I was leading I was just helping. And that's when, at the time, Michelle Lawrence, who's our elected now, was a chief deputy, and she was trying the case with Joe Graham, and they were like, oh my gosh, you have to come work for us. Like, so as soon as there was an opening, you got to come. So, I mean, that's kind of the background of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it'd be harder for me to go back to criminal events now. But, I mean, I think it's just a love for doing that kind of stuff. But I'm just more prone to, I like what I'm doing. So.
And you think probably, I guess, both sides realize this is how the system works. You have to have both.
Right. I mean, we want there to be fairness on both sides. I mean, we have no interest. You know, I do think one of the big things nowadays is like this scary tale of prosecutors wanting to send innocent people to prison. And I have, and no one in this office or none of, we have no interest in sending an innocent person to prison. Like, we justify stuff when we think that it falls into the justification statute. We null-pros stuff when we think that it doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I have null-pros murders before, like, that I didn't think should have been charged.
So that does happen. Yeah,
I mean, we're supposed to be the gatekeepers. We're supposed to make sure that everything is fair for us and for the defense. So we do everything we can. In fact, if I think that an attorney's maybe setting up a Rule 37, I'll be like, hey, you need to object, you know, because I don't want to have to retry it. I don't want to have, you know, any problem. You want it to be fair. And that's what this is about. So we have no interest in sending someone to prison that didn't do it and that we can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
For local content like this and much more, subscribe to the Sentinel Record by visiting hadassar.com and clicking subscribe.
So there have been times, like, you know, like the police will arrest somebody or whoever, and they'll give you the case file, and you're like,
nope.
Yeah, this ain't going to fly.
Yeah, that has totally happened. There's been times where, you know, you look at it, and there's probable cause. And it's not that the police did anything wrong.
Right.
They had the probable cause to arrest somebody. But proof beyond a reasonable doubt is very different than probable cause. Probable cause is it reasonable that this person committed this crime, looking at the facts?
Right.
Beyond a reasonable doubt is beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not 100%, but you should know. You have abiding conviction that this is what happened. And so it's just a different standard for law enforcement than it is us. So.
Right. And you're the one who would have to take the trial. So you're thinking, you know, this is going to get shot down.
So, for example, if there's like a murder case and there is a, let's say that there's, I don't want to pull something, so I'm trying to think of a scenario I haven't had, but if there's like a confession, but there's no corroboration, you can't have that. You have to show that what they're telling is true, because anyone might go in there and try to falsely confess about, I mean, I don't think that's very likely, but it could happen.
Or to protect somebody.
Right. And so you have to have corroboration for this confession, whether it be DNA, eyewitness, phone records, something that, all kinds of different things can corroborate, but something where it's not just the confession alone. So, yes, the law enforcement had probable cause to arrest on a confession, but then the corroboration wasn't there, you know, so on and so forth.
Gotcha. I mean, you see that in, like, movies and TV all the time where somebody will confess to a crime because their kid did it or something.
Exactly, and that's what you try to avoid.
Right.
Or you do avoid. I mean, we won't take a case that doesn't have corroboration to that confession. You can't, so.
Gotcha. I guess the only other thing I can think of is I know people sometimes get frustrated with, like, cases being continued a lot. But there's so many factors that go into that, right?
Well, especially with COVID. I mean, we couldn't try anything. There was from the Supreme Court, you know, we could not try anything for the length of COVID. It wasn't until last year in May that so honestly, the backlog was terrible. I mean, and we like trying cases. It's our job. So we want to try the cases. We want to do that. But yeah, so that's one of the problems. The other is there's only so many judges, there's only so many prosecutors, so we have to do it by priority. So we'll have several trials set, and then whatever is the oldest, who's in custody the longest, and has the most serious violent crime is going to get to go first. There's just a priority about that that you have to follow, and that's from the rules of criminal procedure, and it's statutory as well. Like, you know, you have to do it in this.
And both sides have to be ready, and there's trial dates.
Right. So a lot of times when you're preparing, you think, especially like for a murder trial, like you are preparing and there's just boxes of information and you just miss something because it's so massive. And you're like, oh, I should get this item additionally tested. Or defense might be like, oh, I just realized this affects my defense. And so, you know, something like that. I mean, then it's going to have to be continued because we need that extra bit of evidence. Right. We need to be prepared. An expert might not be available. Like, we can't prove our case without the expert. Or the defense's expert might not be available. Right. You know, there's a material witness.
Or like the defense will just get the, like, oh, we only got the autopsy report 2 days ago. You know, we need more time and that kind of thing.
Right, which we try to not do that.
But you know what I mean, like stuff like that.
Specifically, like, a lot of times it can happen with DNA, because when you're going through labs, it's like, you think you're settled, and then you're like, oh, wow, I just realized that we should have tested this item, and, you know, and it's hard to do that until you're breaking everything down and really looking at the physical evidence, because we don't keep the physical evidence, you know, the law enforcement does, so we have it all brought over for trial prep, and then you kind of catch some stuff every once in a while. I mean, usually that doesn't happen, but it can, so...
Gotcha.
Or a cell phone. I would think the number one reason we have continuances is, so cell phone technology is, we can get into most cell phones, but it's always a couple of years back. So when a murder case might be 3 years old before it goes to trial, well, now we have the technology to dump that phone, and we didn't have it 3 years ago. So we're going to dump the phone in the hopes that there could be exculpatory evidence for the defense. There could be evidence for us. Like, we need to get that. If we get the technology, we need to dump the phone. So that can be it. Probably our number one, I would say, in those cases, murders. I mean, the lab stuff is pretty rare, but the cell phone stuff can happen.
And the lab, they are pretty, they are kind of overworked, aren't they?
I mean, they need more everything. So, having typical, you know, for...
I mean, there's 75 counties.
Yeah.
And one crime lab. So I can imagine.
They have quite a bit of... I mean, honestly, a lot of times for DNA, I have to wait a year. I mean, it's a long process. Right. They have to get them trained, and then, you know, they have to keep them. Because, you know, once they're trained, of course, everyone wants to hire them. So.
Right. Now, I know under the law, like, you have to bring... There's a speedy trial thing. How does that work exactly?
Okay, so speedy trial is... So when I was talking about felony review, you have 60 days to make the decision. Well, if you don't get it bound over to circuit, then they get OR bonded and they're let out. That's why you got to get it done in 60 days. Basically, if they're in custody, you have 9 months to get it tried. If they're not in custody, you have a year to get it tried.
Oh, okay.
That's why custody gets more priority than bond. So the time can be paused, though. So anytime the defense asks for a continuance, you as a prosecutor would say, you know, I have no objection so long as I will hold speedy trial, and that will stop the time.
Right. That doesn't count.
It doesn't count.
If it's there.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's just a few things like that.
So basically it's almost unfair. It's like you've got 9 months, but the defense
can pause it as much as they want.
Ask for as many continuances as they want.
I mean, the only time we can really have the time paused as prosecutors is if we have a material witness missing and we have done affidavits showing our efforts to try to track down that, you know, sent investigators, did everything we could to try to find them, and we just haven't been able to. That can pause the time, but that's about it.
Gotcha. Well, hey, I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
This has been an episode of Inside the Newsroom. New episodes are released every Thursday. Thank you for listening.